Hello, and welcome to Real Crime Profile. We're going to be covering real crime from a behavioral perspective. I'm Jim Clementi, a retired FBI criminal profiler. I was in the FBI for 22 years. Before that, I was a prosecutor in New York City. I love behavioral analysis, looking at criminals from a behavioral perspective. With me is...
Laura Richards. Well, former New Scotland Yard, you can probably tell from my accent, British, but also trained by the FBI and worked at the Behavioural Analysis Unit at Quantico, which is where I met Jim. My expertise is around crime analysis and profiling, and I have a specific expertise around homicide, but domestic violence and stalking, and my background's in forensic and legal psychology. So again, the behavioural perspective is a very important lens that we look through when we're looking at crimes, looking at offenders and victims and their victimology.
Mm-hmm. And I'm Lisa Zambetti. I am very fascinated with true crime, and I'm extremely fascinated by those who solve those crimes. So that's my seat at the table here with these two fine people. So today, this is our first podcast. We're here to talk about something that has swept the nation over this past, over the holidays. I know that's when I got into it. I don't know about you guys, but it's the Netflix documentary, Making a Murderer.
Well, first of all, just to recap what that show, Making a Murderer, was. It was a documentary that covered basically the life and crimes, and I'll put that in quotation marks, of Stephen Avery. He was falsely convicted of an assault and rape on a beach. He actually spent almost 18 years in prison, and then DNA exonerated him. Not just got him out, but actually exonerated him. They knew actually who had raped her. In fact, that guy had confessed to the crime when Stephen Avery was only in jail for about a year. So 17 years later, he was freed from it. So it's quite a miscarriage of justice. Whether that was deliberate or not, we'll talk about in a few minutes. But then, when he was released from prison after being exonerated, he was then shortly thereafter arrested for murder. The murder of Teresa Halbach. And although we'll focus on the Averys and the Dasseys of this case, Laura and I both want to make sure that everyone knows, everybody who's listening knows, that we are here because of Teresa Halbach. We're going to try to give you the benefit of our experience investigating and analyzing behavior so that you can understand it and hopefully protect yourselves and your families and your loved ones. So
Jim, when did it first get into your consciousness about this documentary?
Well, living in Los Angeles, there's billboards all over the place advertising this show. And so I saw Making Murder. Actually, somebody had told me about it, that it was coming out soon and that I would really like it. So I was very busy and didn't really get to it till maybe 2 weeks after it had actually first aired. And a friend of mine, basically at 10 o'clock at night, texted me, "Jim, we got about 8 people sitting around watching this documentary. Have you seen it yet?" And I'm like, "No, I haven't." He said, "You got to watch it. Just watch the first episode." Right. So I went in at 10 o'clock at night and started watching the first episode. Well, I turned it off at 4:30 in the morning. I was addicted. Right. I'll tell you, it at the same time tugged at my heartstrings and pissed me off. And it really asked a lot of questions. It opened up a tremendous number of questions. And I wanted to know more. So I got up the next morning and I watched the entire rest of the series that Saturday morning. So it did hook me in. It brought me on a journey. I was very, very upset with some of the things that it appeared the cops had done and the prosecutor's behavior and so forth. But on the other hand, there was some troubling facts and circumstances that also caught my eye. How about you, Laura?
So I first became aware seeing things on Twitter, actually, the petition going to the White House, and certainly Jim messaging me when I was in Chile with my sister over Christmas, and seeing that actually this was a show that was gripping the nation. So when I came back, I literally had touched down on the Saturday and I binged watched all 10 shows, one after the other. I too found it absolutely compelling, and certainly, you know, not just compelling viewing, and with the caveat, it is a documentary, so it is entertainment. But I started making notes right from the start about some of the interesting things that were depicted and portrayed, and certainly some of the oddities, some of the strange things which made me feel really uncomfortable. But my overriding sense was, this is just such an incredible injustice that's happened upon Stephen Avery and Brendan Dassey. Mm-hmm. How could this possibly happen? Mm-hmm. That was the overriding thing, first of all. And then I too, being a behavioural analyst and a criminal profiler, started to look at other information mm-hmm. that the documentary didn't show. And it started to make me think in a slightly different way about things that were going on, and it answered some of the questions about the potential oddities that I'd already highlighted in my own notes.
So Laura and I both, as a result of sort of the wild response to this documentary series, were both asked to go on shows like Dr. Drew, and we also did Crime Time on the Lip TV, and we discussed this case in a fair amount of detail, but nowhere near the level of detail we're going to be able to do today. And as Laura pointed out, when we each watched the documentary, and I watched it again, most of it with Laura, and we had some serious questions. Obviously, there were some things that stood out right away. First of all, let's talk about the underlying false conviction of Stephen Avery. In that case, he was already in the mind's eyes of the local sheriff's department because he had apparently or allegedly threatened the wife of one of the officers.
Right, and a lot of petty crimes in his background.
Yeah,
he was on their radar for sure.
Yeah, he had already been on their radar for that. But specifically, he had threatened the wife of one of the officers and basically did not get any jail time for it. And that might have been the impetus to make sure that the next thing that came along really stuck. Now, what happened? A woman is basically attacked and dragged into the woods while she's running on the beach, and she's raped. Mm-hmm. And she gives a description of the guy, which generally matches Steve Avery, but also is slightly different in that the eye color was different and some of the clothing was different than what he wears. And specifically, she said he wore a black leather jacket, the attacker, and he had tighty-whitey underwear. Well, even the police knew that Stephen Avery didn't wear underwear,
period. How do they know that? I mean, that is such a detail that is, it's almost hilarious.
Unfortunate,
it.
I mean, yes, but... But
it was certainly something his partner said, that he didn't wear underwear. His
yes.
wife, I think it was, wasn't it,
right.
said that he didn't wear underwear. So therefore, for her, it was a question mark.
Right.
Right from the start.
But when he got arrested, it was because the female officer who was interviewing the victim said, when the victim started describing her attacker, she said, "That sounds like Steve Avery." Now, that's one thing you should never say mm-hmm. in front of a victim.
Right.
And then after that, she gave a description to a police artist. And when I saw this in the documentary, it's uncanny how that police artist's conception of what this guy looked like, based supposedly solely on this victim's description, it looks exactly like the police photograph, the booking photograph of Steve Avery.
Right.
In other words, they actually did this in the documentary. They overlaid the sketch over his actual picture that they took when they arrested him the last time.
Right.
And it was a perfect match. It looks like there's some foul play going on there, like somebody was just setting up Steve Avery.
I think they were actually using the prison picture, weren't they? The artist who did the composite picture.
He didn't admit to that, but it looks very much like that. The hair is even curled in exactly mm-hmm. the same way. Mm-hmm. The thing is that there was another guy who was being investigated for a series of rapes, attacks and rapes, one of them on a beach. And that guy, they didn't even look at because they had blinders on.
I guess that's my question to you, and we'll get to this farther as we talk about the documentary. Like, at what point is that part of law enforcement that once you think you have your guy, you just have to do a deep dive on that guy and everybody else kind of fades into the periphery? Or do you need to still do your due diligence on anybody who is in the periphery haven't cleared?
The former is absolutely not what law enforcement is supposed to do. You're never supposed to predetermine who it is and then gather the evidence against that person. That is exactly what we've learned not to do in law enforcement. What you have to do is let the evidence take you where it does. And when you have a suspect in mind, you still have to run down all the other leads and rule out other people, because people have to understand, since, let's say, OJ, it's very obvious that law enforcement has to rule out other people. If they get tunnel vision, the defense can drive a truck through that case if you haven't ruled out other evidence. If there's leads that come in that you just ignore, what that looks like is you're setting somebody up. Even if you're not, that tunnel vision will prevent you from doing a full, thorough investigation. And the only thing that's going to pass muster for all the appeals and people down the road is if you actually do a thorough investigation.
Right, but that didn't happen in this case.
It did not happen in this case, absolutely. And that was a failure on the part of law enforcement. It came back and basically sullied their face 18 years later when he was exonerated on DNA. And then apparently the very next day, what happened, Laura?
I was just going to say that actually keeping an open mind is the basic tenet of any investigation. So whether you're in the UK or US or wherever you are in the world, it's actually having an open mind right from the start as to what's gone on and who may be responsible. And as Jim says, following all lines of investigation, all lines of inquiry, no matter where they lead, because you are trying to get to the truth. And, you know, that's what should be in the investigator's mind right from the get-go. But we know in this particular case, the sheriff did say that he felt he had his man. So the case was built around, right from the outset,
right,
Stephen
Avery.
Who is
there to oversee that? Who is there to say, wait?
Well, the prosecutor should be, actually. Mm. But that didn't happen in this case. But let's back up. Mm-hmm. The sheriff saying, we have our man. That's exactly what the lead investigator said about Amanda Knox in Perugia. And he said, we didn't need to worry about the evidence coming in yet. We already knew that she was guilty.
Right.
And eventually, it took 7 years to exonerate her. And that's the same kind of thing any law enforcement agency, the same kind of trap they're going to fall into if they have blinders on.
Right.
But you just asked the question, who is supposed to supervise that?
That's
well,
right.
The prosecutor's office is supposed to supervise that. In this case, the prosecutor probably just said, well, the chief of police says they got their man.
Right.
Everybody below them says they got their man. This is what the prosecutor doesn't understand. In a law enforcement agency, if the chief in a police department, if the sheriff in a sheriff's department, if the director in the FBI says, this is our man, we will make this case stick no matter what, everybody underneath them who wants to keep their job is going to want to do mm-hmm. whatever they have to. Even within the law, they can all be believing this guy is guilty, but they could be making a tremendous mistake sometimes. Because what happens sometimes is the evidence does look like it points to somebody, but it could be somebody just like that person, or somebody who set up that person, or somebody who happened by. It depends on the circumstances. And we'll talk later we'll go into details about this kind of stuff and how it actually happens.
And in this case, the DA's wife, if I recall correctly, was it Judy or Jodie, was friends with Penny, the victim of the rape. And I think they spoke at the time when she was in hospital. And when Penny was describing the man who raped her, it was actually the district attorney's wife, Judy, who said, oh, that sounds like Stephen Avery. So I think, you know, even at that point, right from the start, the DA, his wife, other people still, they had a view right from the get-go
that it
was Avery.
And you can understand that she's trying to help her friend. Everybody's distraught. Everybody's upset. So it starts from a place of, I'm, you know, trying to help. But, like, there's not that objective eye saying, wait.
Right. Yeah. But also, what happens after that is sort of like a domino effect.
Right.
So that victim is told, it sounds like Steve Avery. The sketch artist apparently looks at a picture of Steve Avery when he's drawing the sketch. Then that sketch is shown to the victim.
Mm-hmm.
And she said, yeah, that looks like him. They show her a lineup that has the photograph that it looks like that sketch was based on in with five other photographs. And so she said, that looks like him. Well, she's remembering probably the sketch that she just looked at, as opposed to the man who did this crime at that point. And unfortunately, what that sketch did and what that suggestion by Judy did was poison her as an eyewitness. One thing that we have to state for certain, eyewitness testimony is the least reliable type of evidence you can put in a trial. However, juries rely on it so much more than circumstantial evidence, which is actually much stronger than eyewitness testimony.
Absolutely. And then we've got to remember Stephen Avery's background of, you know, seen masturbating in front of women, the background of, you know, when he was a teenager throwing a cat on the fire, setting the scene. I think these are the things that when the sheriff's saying we have our man, he's looking at all the contextual background. You know, this is a family who, you know, at best, should we say, are termed as undesirable or seen as not fitting in with the community, of being something different, and a history of victimization within this family. So in some senses, Stephen Avery's face, in inverted commas, we would say it didn't fit, but actually they made it fit this particular crime.
But one thing that I'm bumping against when I hear something like that, in a different part of the country, this family would be called, they're rascals, they're hellraisers, they're, you know, they're just some good old boys who are, you know what I mean? They wouldn't be characterized as this.
Well,
such,
wait a minute. That's if they were maybe getting drunk on a Friday or Saturday night and having a little fight or showing, blowing up firecrackers or something like this. Stephen Avery poured lighter fluid or gasoline on the cat and threw the cat in the fire.
Yes.
Not what he said in the documentary, which was, I was tossing it back and forth and it fell in the fire.
Right.
All right, so that is a crime. All right, that's a serious crime.
Yes.
And then the other crimes...
He went to prison for it, didn't he?
Yeah.
He had jail time, I think.
And then also the other things were, you know, sexual behavior in public and sort of almost, if I'm not mistaken, stalking behavior, right, Laura?
Absolutely, and targeting women in particular. I mean, there were numerous reports of him masturbating in front of women, and some of those were pending. So there was one in particular on his cousin, who I think was called Sharon, was it, or Sandra, who he blocked in a car, and then he got out of the car and he had a gun with him and he threatened her.
Right, and she was the wife of a police officer. And that was the thing that was the precursor to them saying, the sheriff saying, I want to get this guy this time. This case is not going to fail. Unfortunately, it gave them blinders.
Yeah.
But even despite the fact that Stephen had a sketchy past, he still was falsely convicted of this crime. He did not attack and rape this woman.
And he had an alibi, didn't he?
He did have an alibi.
He actually had an alibi, too.
Yes, he had an alibi, but he still went to prison. He
was convicted. Forensics. He had an alibi, and he was convicted.
It was all based on the eyewitness testimony of that victim. And so that's just a cautionary tale. But the fact is he spent 18 years in prison. And in that time, I'm sure he built up a lot of anger and frustration. However, what did you think, Laura, when you saw his attitude the day he got out of prison?
Well, I mean, it was certainly interesting, wasn't it? Because he seemed quite, it was a very low-key sort of event. And he said that he was kind of prepared to forget about it in many senses and get on with his life, which just seemed to be, you know, slightly strange given the 18 years of his life that he had actually been fitted up. He had been exonerated and he seemed to be, you know, fairly, it looked like shallow affect to me, that it didn't seem to be a genuine reaction.
And by shallow affect, you're saying,
yeah.
Can you explain what that means?
Well, it seemed that he was sort of more hiding something, you know, true feelings, that there was maybe a face that he was putting on for the cameras and for what presenting himself in a certain way, rather than having a true and genuine, you know, most people would think if they had come out for having served 18 years for a crime, you'd be feeling pretty angry at the point where you've been exonerated.
I can see somebody being elated that they finally got out, but having this sort of simmering, they wasted half of my life kind of anger built up behind it. I didn't see any of that exhibited. But aren't there some people who just don't have that depth of emotion, that literally operate on one plane, that don't really think that deeply?
Well, there can be, but he certainly didn't appear to be one of those individuals, given that one minute he's pulling a gun on, you know, his cousin because she's spreading a rumour about him. So you would expect, given that, you know, there are those, well, he and Brendan Dassey had a lower IQ, so their coping mechanisms can be quite different. But it seemed to me that his particular reaction seemed very contained rather than a true reaction.
But why do... What right do we have to expect him to give us any reaction? I mean, yeah, so maybe he was feeling, you know, whatever his feelings are. But to the public, you know, why does he have to perform for us us to believe his sincerity? You know what I mean?
Yeah, but that's not what we're doing. We're not saying he owes us that. But what we're doing is we're evaluating his behavior. That's what we do. See, criminal behavioral analysis is the ability... is the skill and the profession of actually analyzing somebody's behavior when there is no DNA, when there is no fingerprint, when there is no videotape of the crime being committed. We look at behavior, both committed at the crime, but also pre- and post-offense behavior. This would be post-offense behavior. This would be what we would expect somebody who is actually a balanced individual. We would expect them to act in a certain way. Of course, you have to norm each person. You have to see where the variances from the norm are. But in this case, Laura's just pointing out something that stood out to her, and it stood out to me as well. I thought, in one way, it could be manipulation. I thought, wow, you know, I do kind of feel for this guy. Wow, he's been in jail all this time, and he doesn't even seem a bit angry. Wow, I really feel sorry for him. I really feel like he's probably a good guy.
Yeah, maybe that's, you know, it's incredible that he can be have so much humility about him. That was, you know, my initial reaction. He's showing true humility here. But it just struck me as slightly incongruent with all his behaviour before. And that's what Jim's explaining. You've got to put it in the context of what you know about the person.
So it's just we're looking at his behaviour.
Right,
and
right.
It says what it says. I didn't say he's condemned for life because there are some people. There's what we used to call the homicidal triad, okay? Bedwetting or enuresis, fire setting, and cruelty to animals. Mm-hmm. Those are three indicators that are consistent with somebody who's going to grow up to be a killer, for example, somebody who's not, you know, a sociopath or a psychopath.
Unless there's an intervention. Because, of
Unless
course, if there's an early intervention, then it can change behavior.
But also, yeah, but not what I was going to say is certainly not everybody who does those things ends up being a killer or a serial killer or a psychopath. So, you know, everybody has their own. The way I've always explained it is this, is that there's genetics that loads the weapon. Your personality and psychology aim it. And your experiences pull the trigger. And unless you have those three things, like that perfect storm coming together, the person doesn't become a killer. But the way we actually participate in that is not through our genetics. We can't really change our genetics, but our personality is something that we form in our own minds. We actually shape it over the course of our lives with these millions of little tiny private decisions that we make in our minds. Are we going to be cruel to that person or are we going to be nice? Are we going to see somebody hurting and help them or are we going to step on them even further? And that's the way we solidify the good or the bad aspects of our own personality that we're given, and our psychology develops from that, and that's what we then filter all of our experiences through. So two people that have exactly the same experiences could see it totally differently because their personalities accept it as half full or half empty.
So it's never one thing taken in isolation. And that's what I just want to point out to you, Lisa. I'm not saying that, you know, he has to behave or perform in a certain way at all.
Right.
But we look at context and behaviour and understand all of it together, the pattern, not just one thing.
It's important to talk about, to discuss that whether or not that these Manitowoc County Sheriff's Department engaged in a conspiracy to frame an innocent man, or whether or not because the artist, the sketch artist, drew that picture, and whether he had access to Steve Avery's picture or not, it looks very much like he did, whether that was part of a organized conspiracy to actually set him up, or whether once the victim had identified that sketch, and then from that sketch identified Steve Avery's picture, that the police officers literally put blinders on, went straight after him and didn't look anywhere else.
But remember, his name came in first of all through Penny talking to her friend Judy, who was the DA's wife. She was the one who first said, I think that sounds like Stephen Avery. That's
right.
The first point where his name
comes
in.
Yes, but that's information that we know 18, 20 years later. We don't know what the police officers who were investigating the case knew at that moment. Although she started that, Judy was a police officer, right?
No, she was the DA's wife and friend of Penny. So that's how his name first comes in as being the suspect in that particular
raid. So to me, that would only point towards that he's a potential suspect. Obviously, the DA's wife somehow knew of him. I don't know how she knew of him. Did she know of him because her husband had prosecuted him before, or because she just knew him from...
Knew him in the community. That's
what I got
the sense of. It's so a small place.
Right. It seems like everybody knows everybody's business.
Yeah, they know that they're a troublemaker. You know, they're seen as troublemakers. Mm-hmm. And so she speaks to her husband. And so it seems like there were conversations that it sounds like it's Stephen Avery. And that's how the snowball begins.
Right.
And things start to run on from there.
Right. And so what I want to address is that in law enforcement, if the chief of police, I started to talk about this before. Mm-hmm. If the chief of police says, I want to get this man, and the victim has identified the man, most people in a jury believe that if the victim says he's the one that raped me, and then there's evidence that there was a rape, that they're willing to convict for that man for that rape. The jury certainly didn't know that there was another suspect out there who was doing similar acts. And it's questionable whether the law enforcement officers who investigated the case or arrested Steve Avery knew that. We just don't know that. After the fact now, we know that there was another guy, a very viable suspect, who had DNA. At the time, the DNA was not at the level where they could have checked Steve Avery's DNA against the evidence. But eventually, DNA technology got better. And 18 years later, he was able to be exonerated based on that DNA. But that technology was not even available at the time.
Right, but they have pursued him. They maybe would have found he didn't have an alibi. There might have been other evidence besides the DNA.
Well, he was under police surveillance at the time.
Right,
so with Gregory Allen, we've got to remember the detail was that he was under surveillance for raping women.
Right.
At the time, and on that particular day...
No, it was a different police department that was surveilling him. It was not that
same police
department.
I believe from recalling the show, he had been flagged up to that particular police department because of his history of violence against
women. Well, somebody on that detail called up the police department, the Manitowoc County Department, and said, you should look at this guy. We're looking at him for other rapes. But unfortunately, they were surveilling him... But they lost him during the time.
On that particular day.
Right, on that particular day. So they did not have him under surveillance. I don't know whether that was, a scheduling thing or, you know, they didn't have the money to keep it up or whatever. But on that particular day, maybe he knew he wasn't being surveilled and
he
went out and attacked somebody.
Right.
So it's possible that he took advantage of the lack of surveillance that day. But, you know, it's just questionable whether or not the law enforcement officers who actually arrested Steve Avery were ever aware of that at the time, but they may have been. Clearly, the chief knew that Avery had a storied past and had pulled a weapon on the wife of another officer. So he had it out for Steve Avery.
I still have my doubts just with Gregory Allen, who ironically looked very similar to Stephen Avery. But the fact that he had such a history of violence against women and the fact he was in that area at the time and somebody took a decision not to pursue him as a suspect. We don't know if it was the sheriff who said Stephen Avery is our man, but from what I can recall from the documentary, there were a number of people who were aware of Gregory Allen and they decided to pursue Avery and completely ignore the Gregory Allen, who was the far better suspect at the time.
Well, it would have been, yes.
Which is a big public protection risk. I mean, one of the things, the background I come from is working live cases and risk assessing them and risk managing them and ensuring that we keep people safe. And certainly if we have dangerous offenders, where Gregory Allen was a public protection risk full stop. So actually all the time that Stephen Avery was serving his sentence, the 18 years, I wonder how many other women had been abused and violated at the hands of Gregory Allen. Because again, that's right. You know, that's another real public protection area, miscarriage of justice in many respects of those other women who may well have been attacked by him.
Right. And I totally agree. I mean, that's why you want to do a thorough investigation the first time, not to have somebody falsely convicted. Even if Steve Avery was a bad criminal, he wasn't the person who committed this crime, and therefore the person who did commit this crime was able to commit other rapes in the meantime. So that's obviously something we don't want. But what we don't know, because this is just a documentary, and that's one of the things we have to say, is that we're watching a documentary. Unfortunately, we didn't get to sit through the whole original trial or be part of the investigation. I mean, if Laura and I had been there and we actually investigated the case, we would look through all the different interviews and the timetable and when the timeline was and when they knew this information and when they knew that information, and we'd be able to make a more thorough assessment about whether or not he was thoroughly set up, mm-hmm. completely 100% just falsely set up for this crime, or whether they actually thought he did it and they thought everything else was irrelevant. It's a good lesson to learn, though, for police officers. Even if you think you have the guy, if somebody comes up and says, look at this guy too, you should look at that guy too.
Right, right.
Yeah, I mean, is it conscious? You know, is it a conscious decision or is it unconscious incompetence? I mean, they're two quite different things.
Is that like confirmation bias? Is that where that effect comes in, where you start to just see what you want to see?
See everything that fits that. Right. And of course, there will be people around that sheriff who were just following orders and what they were being told. And it could just be a case for some of them where I would call it sort of incompetence, you know, unconscious incompetence. They're just doing these things and they're not really seeing the bigger picture. And as far as they're concerned, they've got their man because his face didn't fit in that town anyway.
Right. And I think in this case, it all comes down to two people. One is the sheriff apparently making an edict. I want this case against Steve Avery to stick. And the sketch artist,
right.
Did he actually do it? Do that sketch based on Steve Avery's picture, or did he just miraculously come up with an exact match to that picture?
Right.
Big questions.
Yes. And I think as a viewer of the documentary, what it does is it really loads the audiences, you know, against the law enforcement of that county, because you see, if they're going to do this at this level, then they surely will do it later down the road.
Absolutely.
You know,
absolutely.
So it's a dramatic turn. It's pretty effective.
And why it's important in this case is because we're about to discuss the next case,
that's
Teresa Holbach's murder.
That's right.
And what preceded that was that Steve Avery's attorneys filed a civil suit against not only the Manitowoc County, but individually a bunch of the police officers who were involved in his original arrest and prosecution and conviction. And because of that, the Manitowoc County Police Department and District Attorney's Office were conflicted.
I just think it's probably worth just mentioning that he was getting his life back together at that stage as well. You know, just giving a bit of context, actually Stephen Avery seems to be getting his life. He's got, you know, a new partner. He's getting stuff back together at the time that those things then start to happen.
Right. And so he files a lawsuit, and Manitowoc County law enforcement and prosecuting's office are conflicted out. So a neighboring county appoints a special prosecutor, and their department is supposed to be doing the investigation of Teresa Holbach's murder.
And now, how close-knit would this law enforcement community be? Would they know each other? I mean, I have no sense of the geography, really, in this.
I have no idea whether they knew each other, but what they would know is that they are police officers, that they are law enforcement, and that they're there to support each other. They're not going to generally. Law enforcement agencies, no matter what people in the world think, law enforcement agencies are not generally doing things illegal. They're generally enforcing laws and protecting people. And one thing I'll say is that there are over 500,000 law enforcement agency officers in the country, federal, state, and local. And we do have a small number, even if it's 1% or 2%. That's still a lot of people. That's 500 or 1,000 people that may do something wrong. But the vast majority of them will not tolerate that, that course, they yeah. do not engage in illegal activity, and they would not break the law to support one another. They do everything within the law to support one another, but they would not break the law.
But you get bad apples in every Absolutely. Environment, don't you? It's not just within law enforcement. It's any business or any walk Exactly. of life where you get people who have a different agenda running.
And unfortunately, when a bad apple is in law enforcement, it has
serious
just
consequence.
Huge consequences.
Yes.
And it turns the public very quickly in that.
Yeah, that trust and confidence, yeah. Goes very quickly. And I think that's what certainly people felt. Certainly I felt having watched the first, false conviction and miscarriage of justice that, the eyebrow is raised as to if they're capable of doing that. What more are they capable of doing?
Right.
Okay. So anyway, there's a conflict of interest between the officers and the agencies that were involved in prosecuting and convicting Steve Avery falsely because there is a civil lawsuit against them. And it's a $36 million civil lawsuit. Now, that's a lot of money and may even bankrupt Manitowoc County. I don't know. So it's a serious issue. Now, whether he would win that lawsuit or not, I don't know. Or the amount of that settlement, if they'd settled, we don't know what it would be. But at the time, there were depositions being taken of a few officers in particular who were involved in the original prosecution, and that would be Coburn and Lenk. Mm. Yeah. Officer Coburn had gotten a call. The officer on the other end of the phone told Coburn that I have Gregory Allen in custody on a rape charge, and he has admitted that he committed a rape of woman in your town, Mr. Coburn, and that you have the wrong guy in prison. Now, we don't know what Coburn did because he didn't make any notation of that call and he did not write any report and he certainly didn't do any investigation to try to find out or even ask follow-up questions to find out who, in fact, was in jail for the wrong crime, for not committing the crime. Who was the wrong person convicted of committing a rape in their town. So we only know about this because the day after Steve Avery is released from prison, Coburn writes not a report, but he writes a memo saying, 8 years ago, I got a call and that person told me that that Gregory Allen has confessed to committing a rape on a beach in your town and I didn't follow up on it. I didn't do anything about it. But clearly, the timing of it indicates that he knew that this is something that's going to come back to haunt them. He better write it up. Maybe he talked to his boss about it. I don't know what actually made him do it, but he did it. He wrote it up 8 years later. So it tells me that that entire time he knew that the person that the guy was talking about on the other end of that phone was Steve Avery.
Absolutely. And the other important thing we need to remember was that they were going to be personally liable. So it wasn't actually the state that was going to be liable with when they were deposed. It was going to be them personally, so as individuals. So therefore, the stakes now are much higher. So him writing that, being aware of the Gregory Allen call and knowing that it came into him and the reason why he chooses to document it 8 years just before he's going to be called with his deposition, I think that's quite an important point. It was an individual liability, not a state liability.
And the reason why it was an individual liability was that apparently the insurance carriers for the Manitowoc County were claiming that if the police officers intentionally convicted the wrong guy, then that they're acting outside the scope of their employment and therefore are not covered by the insurance.
Right.
So I think it's within weeks, isn't it, that they're deposed and then Stephen Avery's arrested.
Yes.
Or rearrested. At the time where he's been, we see in the documentary that he's been getting his life back together. He's got a relationship with Jody. He's seeing his children. It seems that things are going really well for him.
Right.
Yeah. And I think we'll come back to this point later about why would somebody who is on the verge of winning a huge lawsuit against the county on getting, he's got a new girlfriend, a fiance, actually he's going to get married, he's cleaned himself up, he looks like everything.
He literally looks like a different person. I mean,
he's meeting
him,
politicians,
yeah,
he's going to all these swanky dudes.
They actually
put on a pedestal.
The governor and a senator from that state, they actually have introduced a bill called the Avery Bill about making sure that all confessions are videotaped. And that, it's kind of uncanny, but Brendan Dassey becomes one of the first people that were actually interrogated on videotape in that county because of the Avery law.
So it's ironic, and they're two real extremes, aren't they? Him coming out of prison, you know, and spending all that time, and then next minute he's shoulder to shoulder with governors and, you know, on the Innocence Project, and he's got a task force named after him, a new law. They're just complete extreme ends of the spectrum.
And that being in the spot, in that spotlight, you know, again, with every, I mean, it must be an incredible experience to go from being incarcerated for all that time to suddenly being on.
Yeah, I was trying to imagine standing in his shoes, and then, you know, when he's rearrested, just how that must feel to, you know, you then are seeing footage and people don't know that he's been arrested. That's what the documentary has you believe, and that he's being interviewed. And I bet, you know, at that time he just couldn't believe, you know, it's happening all over again.
So, yeah, I remember watching the documentary and thinking, wow, this guy is out, and, you know, this is going to be interesting seeing if he wins this lawsuit against them. And I thought we were going to really get deep dive into seeing whether these law enforcement officers actually set him up or were they just not doing their job properly. And then all of a sudden,
it took a turn that I just could not believe that. I thought it was going to go back to like his reuniting with his children and becoming a father and all that stuff. And you know, development was huge.
They did a good job. I mean, one of the things that documentaries are meant to do is entertain. And it was very entertaining and engaging and emotional roller coaster, that ride that we were on. But when all of a sudden Teresa Holbach disappears, and who was the last person that she had a scheduled appointment with but Steve Avery. And so this does turn everything on its head. And actually, when I'm watching it, it looks like, boy, I'm really feeling sketchy about these this police department, especially when you hear a call on the police radio where the guy says, okay, have we got a body yet or anything? And they say, no. Well, do we have Steve Avery in custody yet? Well, it's, wait a minute.
Again, yeah, once again, it's that rush to...
Are we putting the cart before the horse here? Are they saying, oh, it's him? And, you know, because, hey, that'll get us out of a lot of trouble. Or are they actually following investigative leads at that point?
Yeah, and that feels really uncomfortable. I mean, certainly seeing the officers in his trailer and looking at going through all his personal effects and seeing a letter from, I think it was the Innocence Project, asking Stephen Avery to attend on a certain date. Mm-hmm. And one of the officers just turns around and very casually says, you know, he's not going to be attending that. He's not going to be around for too much longer. And you just think...
Right, yeah. They've already made up their mind. They already... But I want to ask you about that. Okay, the last person to see her alive. I mean, that's what point... How does that make you the suspect? I know that sounds like a dumb question.
It's not a dumb question, because what we look at as behavioral analysts is victimology first, okay? And that means the study of the victim. We look at their risk level. We look at what they're engaged in their life. What would put them in a position of risk or danger? And in this case, Teresa Holbach was just sort of an average person. She wasn't engaged in the drug trade or street prostitution or anything that would put her at a grave risk. But she did, from time to time, she was a photographer, and although she was trying to get out of this business, apparently, she would cover, she would take photos for Car Trader magazine.
So the police investigation will basically follow the footsteps. They try and work out the sequence of events. So they want to work out the last footsteps, if you like, of the victim, and who were the witnesses, who were people who could put her in a certain place at a certain time. And of course, in terms of working out who's the last person to see the victim alive, it's really important because they're either a very significant witness or they could be the killer. So they're the two things that the police would be thinking, and it's a painstaking process actually doing the sequence of events and working out those last footsteps and who saw that person where and when. You know, Stephen Avery claimed that she left his yard and, you know, she was alive when she left. Well, she would have been picked up by other people if that were the case. And, of course, this is when the timeline becomes really important. the timelining with the sequence of events, of other people corroborating what happened, where it happened, and when it happened.
So, I mean, and as we see in the documentary, though, the other people saw her at that same time that he saw her. So it doesn't really seem like he was the last person, because there are several other witnesses, the bus driver, Brendan, who saw her too at that same time.
Absolutely. And then there's that whole discussion about, you know, there were some time discrepancies about, you know, what happened with Brendan and the bus driver and where she was and what the windows of time were between her potentially leaving Avery's and, you know, her disappearing, as it were.
Right, and that whole property seems like people are in and out of that property, that there could be any number of people who she could have.
Well, there could, but what the police have to do is start with the known ones. And she had an appointment with Steve Avery. She had an appointment to photograph a car that he was trying to sell. Mm-hmm. So that's important. She made the appointment before that, and she made the appointment before that. And she was able to be seen by people at Steve Avery's property. So it is the first place you want to look. And what you do is you start investigating in concentric circles around the last sighting. You get the window of opportunity. You find out when she was last, you know, she was last seen. And then you see where she went from there. What direction was she heading? And that kind of stuff. So those are the kinds of questions they'd be asking him originally. Mm-hmm. He told them, she was here. I didn't really talk to her. She must have taken pictures and she left. Well, later when they do a search, they find an invoice from the trader, and it looks like actually they did interact, because how did he get that invoice otherwise? And so that's an inconsistency. But at the same time, there were people out, volunteers out, searching for Teresa, her car, and any kind of indication of whether she was alive or not. Now, her boyfriend and her brother both apparently accessed her cell phone.
Yeah, her ex-boyfriend, I think it was. They were together. And I think, didn't they go up to the yard as well and they started a search? So you've got the police up there and then you've got civilians also trying to conduct a search too.
But when she goes missing, I know it's the last person she spoke to, but don't you immediately start to think about her relationships and the
Absolutely.
People who were in
Absolutely.
Her life.
Her roommate, you know, question mark, when did they last see her? Her ex-boyfriend, her brother, you know, all of those people you want to, as Jim said, it's a concentric circle, you know, that you just keep building and building, you know, asking more questions of people and trying to build up a picture of exactly what happened. And so, at that stage, she's a missing person. So there's a big difference between a missing person inquiry and a murder inquiry. And sometimes that's a difficult thing to call. You know, at what stage does a missing person inquiry become a murder investigation?
Right. And so you look at, again, this is all victimology questions. So you look at the relationships. You look at her roommate. Talk to him. See, did she plan on coming home tonight? Was she seeing somebody else? Did she often just disappear for days at a time? The old boyfriend. He seems very concerned, and he comes by the house every now and then, right? He was there that day or the day before, and he saw her. Did she break up with him because he was abusive? Did she break up with him because she met somebody else? Was he, you know, good
yeah,
with
that?
Yeah,
but they never get to that.
Well, when you see, wait. What never gets to that? How do you know they didn't get to that? What you saw on the documentary is one thing. I'm talking about what the police investigation should do.
Uh-huh.
And that's what we're talking about. We don't know whether they talked to that person at all. What you saw is a documentary, which is not – none of the police cooperated with that documentary. None of the prosecutors cooperated with the documentary.
And why would that be? I mean, just they're protecting their case and they don't want
– Well, there was a civil lawsuit. And they were named in it. So that could be why. And then when you settle a civil lawsuit, there's usually a gag order. You're not allowed to talk about the circumstances around it. So that might be why.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't know for sure. Mm-hmm. But it's also, they could know that they could be aware. Let's say one person did an interview with them. Or because they're doing all these interviews, and because they know that they were already talking to the Averys, that they felt like it was going to be negative towards law enforcement. It may have been somebody from up high who said, I don't want any of my officers talking to this documentary team, and I don't want the prosecutor could have said the same thing. Law enforcement in general does not talk without approval from their bosses. They do not speak to the press, period.
But they were talking all over the place in these press releases.
In the press conferences. That's right. And those are the bosses, and they're allowed to talk. But law enforcement officers are not allowed to just talk on their own. They have to have authority.
Yeah. They have to be told that they can do it. And I think certainly, I mean, we'll talk about the press conferences, because for me that was unprecedented to see at the point of trial them being questioned by the media at the end of each day, which would not happen in the UK. So there were some anomalies, I think, certainly for me watching it, and certainly in terms of how it could change the process when key bits of evidence are being discussed in the media before they're even at trial, because there were lots of things put in the media.
Those are two very different things legally here. Here, prosecutors are allowed to talk during the course of trial. Once information has come out in a trial, then it's public information. But something that happened in this case that doesn't typically happen with prosecutors is that they held press conferences before the trial started, right in the middle of the investigation. In fact, very early in the investigation. And actually told details that were not known to the general public. And that is not only a violation of the privacy of the victim, because they should have been in paramount concern, should have been the privacy of the victims and the victim's family. And they totally threw that away and made a very graphic presentation. Because of the conflict of interest, Calumet County stepped in to do the investigation, and their DA's office, at this represented by the district attorney Kratz, actually took over the prosecution. And this is when they started doing press conferences. Mm-hmm. And what the lead investigator from Calumet County said was that Manitowoc County was not going to actually be involved in the investigation of Stephen Avery for the murder of Teresa Holback because of the conflict of interest.
Right, and they said that.
They announced it.
That's right.
And they said that Manitowoc County was only going to be providing tools and vehicles and any kind of support like that if they didn't have the actual machinery.
Resources, more than anything.
Investigators. So this is all the time we have today. And we have just scratched the surface. But we will be back.
That's right.
Until we finish talking about this entire case. And some of the things we want to talk about are how they discovered the car, how they discovered the body, how they got the search warrant, what the search warrant actually was meant to do, what the date was, what the property was that they were supposed to search. These are really important factors that will then end up resulting in a prosecution or an acquittal, a successful prosecution or an acquittal. Mm-hmm. So those are some of the things I want to talk about. Laura, what else?
Well, we also want to talk about the arrest and the interviews as well. And,
absolutely.
You know, we've only just scratched the surface, as you said, but talking about what evidence they had and what they didn't have, and hopefully get into Brendan Dassey as well at some point. But there's so much more that we want to go through.
There is so much more to this case.
And there's physical evidence like the key and a bullet and blood and the car and bones and cell phones and camera. All these things we're going to talk about when and where and how they were found and what they actually mean. Also, we'll get back into what eyewitness testimony was in this case and differences in timelines and who is credible and who is not credible.
Right, and other suspects and other people, right?
The media. I think it's quite important, you know, for us to discuss that, of what was put in the media, the details, what was said and at what point, because, of course, then that can create issues further down the line, shall we say.
And you're going to find that we're looking at it, Laura and I are looking at it from a behavioral perspective, but even between us, we have different perspectives. I have a background in law and chemistry. When I worked in the FBI, I did violent crimes and I did...
Not committing them, of course.
No, I didn't. I investigated.
That sounds wrong.
Well, I investigated. Sorry, Jim. That's okay. Thank you for clarifying that, because I may have gone down the wrong way there. But I investigated violent crimes, and I also was on the evidence response team. So I actually did evidence recovery, the FBI's version of CSI, for many years. And I also investigated violent crimes, murders, serial crimes. And so all of that gives me a particular perspective, and Laura has a different perspective.
Yeah, so my perspective, I'll be coming from, again, looking at the behavioural context, the nuanced behaviour, linguistic analysis, what people say and how they say it. Mm-hmm. My expertise around domestic violence and stalking. Certainly we, having been on Dr. Drew last week, were discussing the recent disclosures by his former fiancée, Jodie, in terms of domestic abuse. So we want to cut into some of that behaviour at some point and whether she's a credible victim and witness.
Yeah, I
want to
talk about Jodie. I got a lot of questions about her. Yeah.
Great.
I think lots of people do.
Yep.
So clearly we have a lot to discuss. So we hope you'll come back and listen to further podcasts. And
we also want to give a shout out to Bob Ruff. Bob
definitely
Ruff.
Wanna...
So if you guys don't know who he is, you should. You should check out his podcast, which is called Truth and Justice. That's where I got turned on to him, talking about the Adnan Syed case. It was a spinoff, kind of the Serial podcast. He's awesome. He's got a great podcast. So check him out.
Yeah, definitely. And I did an interview with Bob, and Laura and I are about to do another one very shortly. So at the time you hear this, we may or may not have that online as well. And if you want to follow us on Twitter, it's at Real Crime Profile, all one word, RealCrimeProfile. So follow us on Twitter. We'll let you know when our next podcast is coming out, and we'll give you all the information about where you can stream it and download it and so on and so forth.
And also be sure to check out Criminal Minds on CBS Wednesdays at what time, Jim?
9 o'clock.
That's right.
And on about 20 other times during the week.
And Jim's got a episode coming up.
I do have an episode
really
coming
cool.
up.
Really cool.
Yes. We're in the middle of shooting. Well, we're going to start shooting our 250th episode of Criminal Minds.
250, you guys.
It's pretty amazing.
It is amazing.
Yeah. And Laura just recently got laws changed in the UK.
What?
Want to tell them about that?
What?
Yep. So, and it kind of ties into this case in some respects. So on coercive control, domestic violence. So our new law piece of legislation was enacted and implemented on December the 29th. So it's very exciting having changed the law on stalking over there. And now on domestic violence, and I'll be looking very closely to see what happens back in the UK now those laws are being used, and whether the US are interested too, different states of course, but in learning some of the lessons and vice versa, US to the UK and UK to the US.
So you can follow me at Jim Clementi on Twitter, and you can follow Laura on...
at LauraRichards99.
You guys are awesome. Thank you so much for doing this, and I can't wait for our next talk.
Thank you very much, Lisa. Thank you, Laura.
Thank you.
So if you're a fan of the show and you want to help us out, there's a few things you can do. First, subscribe to the show on iTunes, talk to your friends about us, and share the links. And it'd also be great if you could take a survey from our new network, Wondery, at wondery.com/survey.
For advice or support, if you're experiencing stalking in the UK, you can contact Paladin National Stalking Advocacy Service on 0207 840 8960 or go on the website www.paladinservice.co.uk. If you're experiencing domestic violence, call the National Domestic Violence Helpline free phone 0800 2000 247. In the US, if you're experiencing domestic abuse and need advice, shelter, safety or counselling, call the Genesis 24-hour hotline 214-946-4357 or go on the website www.genesisshelter.org or you can call the National Domestic Violence Hotline on 800-799-7233.
Real Crime Profile is produced and edited by Paul Francis Sullivan, engineered by Jacob Moose Molin. Music is composed and performed by Simba Sumba. Logo art by Rob Cohen. Real Crime Profile is produced and recorded at Empire Studios LA by XG Productions. Real Crime Profile is distributed by Wondery.